Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a five-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. And a very happy Saturday, April 13th, 2024 to everybody. This is Chase back with the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. As always, joined by Nick and now joined by Jason. Nick, how are you doing? Jason, how are you doing?
Doing great, Chase. Good to be back as always.
Doing well, Chase. Happy Saturday. Lots to discuss.
Yes, there is. This is like, we started going through the topics here and more stuff came in. We had a couple listener requests and there's just a ton of stuff. I think let's start pre USC stuff and just talk about the Final Four, because the Final Four happened this past weekend, the weekend before. Obviously we got UConn and Purdue winning their semifinal games against respectively Alabama and NC State. I was at the games in Phoenix. Neither one was close at the end, but they're kind of close for the first 30 minutes, and they're, you know, well-played games. A couple notes from being there. I would say of the four teams showing up to play for the semifinals, Purdue probably had 60% of the fans there at least. And after Purdue won the first game, things cleared out a bit. I mean, Purdue's fans stuck around for the most part, but a lot of them went down kind of near the concession stands and hung out there. You really felt the impact of the Purdue fan base. That's the Big Ten fan base we're going to be staring at ourselves at going forward as SC fans. These were clearly the two best teams in that played, in my mind, on Saturday. I guess you could say if Alabama played Purdue, would have been interesting. I think Purdue would have won that game. And I think they're, you know, essentially the two best teams all year, except for Houston, which had, the bad luck with injuries and then Shed injuring himself in Sweet 16 game against Duke. So, and then from there on, we went, UConn kind of just cleaned up and just was kind of a machine. So, I don't know, Nick, do you have any takeaways from just watching the semifinals and watching the championship game? And what kind of, UConn has pulled off this last couple of years?
I've got a lot of thoughts. I don't think any of them are groundbreaking. It's basically what I expected. I mean, Alabama, we can just go team by team here. They're a very high variance team because they take a lot of threes, and they were competitive in that game as long as they were making threes. And they were shooting a super high percentage from three for the first 30 or so minutes of that game. And, UConn just outlasted them in the last 10 minutes or so of that game. But I think with them, you have to play pretty much a perfect game to beat UConn. And Bama was kind of doing that for the first 30 minutes before the wheels came off a bit. That game was a lot closer, I think, than the final score indicated, but UConn was pretty clearly the superior team. To back that up a bit with the whole, like, playing a perfect game to beat UConn, you look at the Kansas game, one of UConn's three losses. It was a 4-point game at Fog Allen, insane home crowd for Kansas. Kansas went 9-for-14 from three against UConn and still only managed to win by four, which just illustrates how well you have to play to beat this UConn team. I think that was kind of expected there. NC State, great run. Purdue, just too much for them from a personnel standpoint. And the other thing that stood out, I think, was just how UConn guarded Edie in the final. Great game plan. They went one-on-one, let Edie get his, basically. But Klingon is dynamic enough as a defensive player to make him work for it and keep his efficiency down enough where that defensive strategy makes sense. Tennessee tried doing the same thing in the previous round, but you know, Jonas Adu, as good as he is on defense, isn't like a Donovan Klingon level defender. So yeah, I really liked UConn's game plan, and man, like winning back-to-back national championships with, you know, while having no game within 10 points is a remarkable, remarkable achievement by Dan Hurley.
What about you? You got anything, Jason?
Yeah, I would say 3 points. Number one, UConn's roster construction, right? Just if you want to take it as a template for what teams should be thinking about moving forward, right? Their top six, they have Tristan Newton, obviously a star player, transfer, upperclassman, comes from East Carolina. They've got Cam Spencer, transfer, upperclassman, comes over from Rutgers. Hassan Diarra, six-man, transfer, upperclassman, comes over from Texas A&M. And then they're complementing that by bringing in a couple of targeted, highly recruited guys. Stephon Castle, freshman, big, five-star, number nine recruit. And then two sophomores, right? Klingon and Alex Caravan, both four-star guys, you know, in the kind of 70 to 125 range as recruits. So just if you're looking at how do you put together a championship caliber roster and one that is constructed on the fly this year, because they lost a lot of production from last year, it's all about finding that balance from the portal and from your own recruits. Point number two would be just thinking about how you need to be good on both sides of the ball to win it all. And so UConn ends the season at KenPom, right? Number one in offense, number four in defense. And that becomes important in tournament play because you're not reliant on only one thing. You know, Nick mentioned, right, the 3-point variance with Alabama, right? If they're not making the threes in a one and done tournament, it becomes that much harder to win. And to kind of bring it back around to USC, right? That's one of the cool things about Musselman as a hire. You know, some coaches USC could have looked at, like a Brian Dutcher, for example, unquestionably elite on defense, but have never quite put it together on offense. So I think what that does is give you a higher floor maybe, but also a lower ceiling. If you know you're only going to have it on one side with a guy like Musk, the systems are at least in place to potentially succeed on both sides of the ball. And he's shown an ability for his teams to do just that. And the last thing is just kind of at a macro level, this run that Connecticut's been on since 1999. You guys don't know, I actually grew up in Connecticut. I was 11 years old when Connecticut won their first men's title in 1999. They'd obviously just started cleaning up on the women's side with Geno a few years before that. But, you know, for a program that they keep winning national championships and people were wondering, are they a blue blood? Are they a blue blood? I think at this point with six titles in 25 years, I think we can end that debate and firmly put them in that club. So very, very impressive run by them.
One of the similarities they have with UCLA's run under Wooden, which, you know, different eras, there's a lot of different things going on, but UCLA, when they made the Final Four, won it. They won the championship, and UConn has done the same thing. Now 6-0, right, in the championship games, which is just, I mean, that's pretty remarkable. Building on just a couple other points you made, Jason, let's go back, starting with Villanova's first championship under Jay Wright. They finished the season number three in offense, number five in defense in KenPom, number one overall in KenPom. North Carolina wins the next year. They're actually 11th in defense, 9th in offense, and 3 overall, but still very high. Villanova wins its second championship, 11th in defense, 1st in offense, number one overall. Virginia comes in with Tony Bennett the next year, beats Texas Tech in the final. Number two in offense efficiency, 5 in defensive efficiency, number one overall. After the COVID year, we obviously have Baylor beating Gonzaga in the championship. And this was the one that's kind of the outlier, because Baylor was only 22nd in defense, even though they're number two overall. I'm not exactly sure how that was arrived at. Maybe it was a couple bad games. I think, did Davion Mitchell miss some games that season? That might have accounted for why they would have maybe slumped in defense, because they seem to be much better in defense. I mean, they're actually in very close numbers wise. So I'm not, that was very tight. Following season, Kansas wins it, 6th in offense, 17th in defense, number 3 overall. last season. We have UConn winning the first of the back-to-back. Number one overall in KenPom, third in offense, seventh in defense. This year, first, as Jason said, first in offense, fourth in defense. Every single national champion finished in the top, you know, for the last decade, basically now has finished in the top three in KenPom, most being number one. You just need to be very efficient offensively and defensively, no question about it. And you're definitely seeing, you know, once you get to that Final Four, typically the best team is winning, right? I mean, I guess there's that when Baylor beat Gonzaga and kind of like boat raced them the first 10 minutes of that game in the 2021 season. Clearly, I think Baylor was the better team, but, you know, they had maybe suffered in KenPom because of some stumbles earlier in the season. I know Baylor, I think Baylor, didn't they not play a game for like three consecutive weeks or something because they had a COVID pause?
I think they were actually supposed to play Gonzaga at some point during that season in like South Dakota when they were doing all those neutral sites games, and they ended up not playing the game, if I remember correctly,
right?
Because of COVID. And so then they ended up finally playing each other for the championship.
Yeah. So that probably accounted for some of the variance you saw there with Baylor, but you just need to be very efficient on both sides of the ball.
One note too about that Baylor team. Like, I know there was a bit of a narrative about how they were like fading as the year went on, but that team went 28-2. Their only two losses were at Fog Allen and against Cade Cunningham in Oklahoma State. And that's it. They won, you know, the other 28 games. That was a really freaking good team.
Oh, it was a fantastic team. Fantastic team. And at a conference, they beat Auburn and Washington or in Illinois earlier in the season. I mean, it was a really good team. So let's skip now and talk a little bit about maybe some of the what's happened with this coaching carousel thing, and just the domino effect of SMU. The SMU really put into place here. I don't know if we've ever quite seen anything like this, and it's not totally done yet, because BYU still has an opening. But we've now gone to the point where this opening at that SMU wanted to create for itself, essentially firing a coach who had vastly improved the team year over year. And just, you know, I got the numbers right in front of me here. Lanier, his first year, he goes 10-22, second season, 20-13. I mean, and takes them from 183 in KenPom to 72 in KenPom. Now, maybe you can make the argument that they never should have been as bad as 183 in KenPom, whatever you want to argue about that. He was bringing them back to where they kind of had been at a minimum under Jankovic. Maybe not back to the Larry Brown level yet, but maybe they're heading in that direction. SMU decides we're going to the ACC. We need a big splash hire. They try to get any number of other coaches, including Musselman, and who they end up with is Andy Enfield. That triggers all of these other openings. Musselman moving from Arkansas to USC. And that really allowed, I mean, this kind of, it allowed a couple programs that wanted, I think, to move on from their coaches, but couldn't move on because of, you know, having to pay the rest of the contracts out. Andy Enfield owed about $16 million or so at USC. John Calipari owed about $33 million at Kentucky. He moves on to Arkansas. And then that opens up the spot at Kentucky. And it's kind of bizarre after, you know, they flirt with some of the biggest name coaches, Dan Hurley, obviously back-to-back championships. And I guess between he and his wife, they had no interest in going to Kentucky. Scott Drew decides he doesn't want to take the job. Nate Oates from Alabama. That's not entirely clear who made that decision, but I think it seemed like it was Oates deciding he didn't want to leave Alabama for Kentucky, which is understandable. They fire right off to Mark Pope, a former Kentucky player, won a national championship for a Patino team in the late 90s. That is a pretty big stretch. I mean, I think, you know, Nick, when we had discussed this, we almost considered Mark Pope kind of like a safety coach for us, like the safety pick in case the others fell through.
Right, we did. And I think both of us were pretty impressed by his background, right? I mean, given what he's done at BYU, especially with their offenses, he's risen that program, you know, to a the highest level, at least in recent memory, surpassing Dave Rose and some of his predecessors there. So I know Kentucky fans were furious, right? Like, hire the BYU coach, one tournament win. But I think Mark's a really smart guy. He's got the pedigree from his time in the NBA and playing for Patino, a lot of recent success. I think he can work at Kentucky, especially if they give him, you know, the amount of NIL necessary to compete. So I'm not going to, you know, say it's like a grand slam hire or anything like that. And, you know, he's certainly not the name of Billy Donovan or, you know, Scott Drew, Dan Hurley, or anything like that. But I definitely could see Pope working if they put the right pieces around him here.
So, Jason, I mean, I'll let you kind of just give your overall thoughts on this whole process for all these schools, whatever you want to make of it. I'll just a couple of notes. I don't think Pope has actually did win a tournament game. I think he made it.
Is that right?
Yeah, he would have made it in the COVID shortened season. But there was no tournament. And then he made it twice with BYU, went out in the first round. I also believe he's never recruited an NBA player, which is quite something to think about. Never recruited or coached. So throwing it over to you, Jason.
Yeah, look, when you see kind of the sum total of this carousel, it's a really weird one because you think about the jobs, right? They weren't all open at the same time, but when you kind of take a step back, Kentucky was open, Louisville was open, Ohio State was open, Michigan was open, right? And then you look at like where the marquee coaches, so to speak, ended up, and you end up, you know, Arkansas was like up a creek without a paddle for a minute there. And then all of a sudden they pull a rabbit out of their hat. Now they have John Calipari. I think they can feel happy that they did well in this. USC can feel ecstatic with Musselman. But then you start to look at like what some of these other schools did, right? Louisville going to Pat Kelsey, Ohio State going with the interim, right? Promoting Jake Diebler. And now Mark Pope, right? Kentucky going with the alum route. Like it just feels like the marquee brands did not necessarily end up with the marquee coaches. And I think there's a few reasons for that, right? Like you can say, you know, with NIL, maybe you can win anywhere. Maybe the pressure is just so much at some of these places that while it seems like a great job because you've got a lot of support, you have a lot of pressure as well. And certainly for someone like Musk coming from Arkansas to USC, I think there's certainly less pressure for him to win. But like if I were ranking the top coaching hires of this cycle, like I'd be looking at Cal to Arkansas. I'd be looking at Musk to USC. I think DePaul did really well randomly with Chris Holtman. I mean, I know he kind of flamed out a little bit at Ohio State, but that's like still a coach with a winning track record over the last decade at a couple spots going to a place that's had absolutely nothing to write home about for decades, right? Landing at a credible place. And then a few of these up and coming coaches, right? Darian DeVries going to West Virginia, Kyle Smith to Stanford, Dusty May to Michigan. I like all of those moves. And then kind of my tier three would be like, you know, Enfield to SMU, Pope, Kelsey. I think Danny Sprinkle is a promising young coach, but like haven't quite seen enough of a track record beyond this past year. Mark Byington to Vandy, Steve Lutz, Oklahoma State, and then Diebler, as I mentioned, for Ohio State. So those are all the power conference jobs that got filled. And I think USC fans can feel like they came out, you know, on the positive end of all those transactions.
And it is really remarkable. And look, we had some fortune for the timing and just kind of the way things were working out. The fact that the women's program, I think, had done well, I think was probably a little bit of, I know Musk was looking to get out of Arkansas, probably would have loved, you know, the SC job no matter what. But the fact that like the women's program is doing so well, it's got to be like a little bit of a positive because now he knows like you've got an enthusiastic donor base, especially with Lincoln Riley there. Maybe there's competition for dollars, but a lot of times just a lot of energy and positivity around the school and the athletic program can build momentum and is, you know, a rising tide, you know, lifts all boats. But yeah, absolutely. It is bizarre how you have Ohio State and Kentucky and Louisville filling job with guys. I mean, the Pat Kelsey resume looks a lot like the Mark Pope resume, quite frankly. The Diebler thing in Ohio State, I don't really understand why they felt the need that, I mean, they've got, they're flush with cash. They could have made a run at a whole, any number of different coaches. And I guess they felt like, well, this guy's winning enough that that's good to go.
And one note on that too, like Holtman's buyout was over 10 million. So they paid over 10 million to hire to buy out Holtman to hire his assistant. So that was really weird.
That is very weird. That very weird situation. I think Michigan made out pretty well. We don't know. We don't really have enough to information on Dusty May in the sense that like he has put together one really good team and a team that at a place you would never expect to make the Final Four made the Final Four. So that's really a credit to him. Is it going to be like a Shaka Smart situation where when he gets a big job? I mean, Michigan is. It can be a very big basketball job. It can be a lot like a Texas job. And is that going to be too big for Dusty the way that maybe the Texas job was just too big and kind of complicated for Shaka? Well, I guess that remains to be seen. But all things considered, like I think if you're just kind of doing an objective analysis here, you have to say, okay, Arkansas got Calipari. It's hard to ever argue against a Hall of Fame caliber coach. And then USC got Musselman. That seems to me to be, those are the marquee hires, and it's pretty clear to me.
I would throw Kyle Smith at Stanford in there too. I mean, I think he's a really quality coach. And given that Stanford's their athletic department, you don't really know how serious they are about winning, just given what they've done over the last several years here. I think that was a home run for them too.
I would add that just this week or yesterday, I think news broke that Kyle Smith was able to re-recruit Marcus Renard, the French basketball player, who was really one of the top players in the Pac-12 last season. I think arguably like the best player, maybe not, but I mean you can make the argument. And he had entered the transfer portal, and now he's returning to Stanford. He was a math major at Stanford, had done 3 years there. So I guess it makes some sense he wants to kind of complete his degree and before leaving the States. But that's a big pickup for Kyle Smith. And Smith has done well with bigs, as we've known from Gay and Abidi and what he did this past season with Isaac. What's his last name?
Jones.
Jones. Yeah. So. That's a huge get for Stanford, and I think that's going to keep them, competitive at a very minimum. Okay, well, look, it is bizarre, and we'll have to see how this all goes. For SC in this now, it's funny because we're entirely remaking the roster. I think that we expected this. Everybody has left except Harrison Hornery, who I think. We think may stick around. And then there's Brandon Gardner, which is a strange situation. Just not to give away too many premium details, but there's a Discord channel that Trilly Donovan runs called The Burner, which I would encourage everyone to join. And he has on there a transfer portal like preview list. It's like guys he before the season ended, the guys he thought would jump into the transfer portal. The number one name on the list was Brandon Gardner from USC. He's, other than Harrison Hornery, the only guy that hasn't left the program at USC yet. He still may, but he's the only one, left with Harrison Hornery. I mean, we're talking about rebuilding an entire roster. I would encourage everyone to go over to the USChoops.com website, check out the new personnel thread, because it talks about all the information that's become public on USC is going after. Is there. And then when I say public, I mean like it's been listed on Twitter one way or another. I didn't include guys like Kylan Boswell, even though there's rumors about that. The stronger rumors I've heard is that he's going to Illinois, and the SC was not necessarily a factor, but I could be wrong about that. I don't know. But anyway, that's the list of who we know about. I'm sure there's others, like for example, broke yesterday that Dre Davis from Seton Hall was going to be on campus this weekend. And we didn't, no one really knew that. I mean, there had been no discussion about that. So there could be a whole bunch of other guys that Mus is recruiting we don't know about. But before we talk about the guys that have been kind of discussed, you know, Jason, what are your thoughts on, like, what, putting aside what Mus is likely to get this time around? Because, for example, he's gotten Clark Slackert from Penn, and he's gotten Josh Cohen from UMass. Those are not exactly kind of like guys that you would typically profile from Mus. But what do you expect? What kind of players are you expecting Mus to be looking for?
Yeah. So Chase, one thing that I heard loud and clear from all the media that Mus did at his press conference, some podcast appearances that he's done in the past couple of days, he was pretty clear about what he wants the teams to look like. And he left some room to say, hey, I don't have a roster at all yet. Maybe it won't be this. But in a perfect world, he said he wants his teams to be long and athletic. He wants them to react quickly to loose balls. He wants them to be a high volume free throw attempt team that attacks the rim, gets in the bonus early, puts pressure on defenses. And he said, we'll never play zone defense, no matter what. And so that's kind of the prototype, right? If you're looking for what types of players to go after in the transfer portal, it's, he also said, he wants to, if he was going to over index on one type of player on the roster, that he wants guys that are between 6'5 and 6'8, you know, can switch multiple positions, kind of interchangeable, multi-skilled guys. And so I think when you look at USC's recruiting board right now that you've put together, Chase, like, you see a lot of those guys that can slash, get to the rim, get fouled, make the free throws. That is, seems like number one thing that Mus is looking for right now.
You have any thoughts on this, Nick?
Yeah, lots of names fit that profile. I think Jason really hit it head on there. One guy that really stands out in that regard is Jordan Durkak from Merrimack. Merrimack wasn't that good. They were 212 in KenPom, but they were 79th defensively. They just had a terrible offense. And, you know, Durkak, 47th in the country in free throw rate, so he got to the rim. Top 100 in steal rate, can also pass. So if he can ever get the jump shot where he hits threes, he's going to be a really dangerous piece. But even if that doesn't come, he's a really nice, like, Swiss Army knife type that can get to the rim and play really good defense.
And there was some reporting on a, you know, so he's from kind of that, like, Jersey, East PA type area. The other schools you're looking at are not, you know, Penn State, Seton Hall, you know, I think maybe Rutgers is on that list. Not surprising, but in the profile, the Penn State, site analyst had said he had heard SC was very involved there. He does seem to be a great fit for a Mus team. And the fact that he's not, like, a great three-point shooter wouldn't seem to hurt that, because I don't think that would be necessarily the biggest priority for Mus. I think Mus would probably tell him to shoot fewer threes, attack the basket more. I believe he was the Northeastern Conference Player of the Year and the Defensive Player of the Year. Am I right about that?
Not sure, but wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. I will. Yeah, he was on the all conference list. So, I'm correct about that he was. And that's a team coached by Joe Gallo. They Merrimack is, he's been there for, gosh, a while now. And brought them from Division II into Division I. So this is if you haven't heard a lot about Merrimack, it's because they haven't really been playing Division I basketball very long. So let's cover some of the names that I think are important, because I think they're more likely that USC is really targeting them strong. They're Darren Boyd from Lipscomb, committed today to Charleston. New Charleston coach there is Chris Mack, the old Louisville coach. So that's a big get for him. Marquez Warrick from Northern Kentucky, more of a conventional guard. It seems like Muss has prioritized him. I'm not sure if that's still the case. Dre Davis is obviously on campus today. He's supposed to take, they say, a handful of visits to other schools. So we don't know exactly who else is involved with him right now. DeShane Montgomery from Mount St. Mary's. I think he is an absolute big time target. 6'4", kind of just maybe he's maybe an inch shorter than that 6'5" to 6'8" range that we were discussing before, but long. I think he's got a 6'10" reach, gets steals, really kind of came on at the end of this past season, and he was only a freshman, so I think he's going to be a key guy to look at. Alston Mason from Missouri State. He had transferred from Oklahoma previously. And the other one I think we really need to talk about is
To you.
sorry, that's my daughter. Keyshawn Hall from George Mason. The list of schools that he's supposed to be looking at keeps getting smaller and smaller. And there's all kinds of rumors that he is told Mussie's coming. So those are the kind of the ones I think are worth looking at. Jason, based on those guys, anyone else you've seen on the list, anyone you think it's worth just making note of?
Yeah, a couple things, Chase. I think out of all these guys, the one that I would be most excited about is Dre Davis, right? Coming from Seton Hall is a guy who just made the game-winning shot in the NIT championship, arguably best offensive player on a bubble team, playing more than 80% of their minutes. Very, very disruptive on defense, one of the best shot blockers on the board. And a really strong shooter, 54% from two this year, 35% from three, 84% from the line. So, very, very intrigued by him. In terms of the other guys you mentioned, the other one that really jumps out to me as being interesting is Keyshawn Hall. One of my close friends actually lives down the street from George Mason randomly and goes to almost all their games. Keyshawn was his son's favorite player, hands down the best player on their team. Often playing the four at 6'7", just based on their roster construction, but he really fits this kind of Muss mold of getting to the line and converting rebounds extremely hard on the defensive end. Sounds like he may need a really strong voice to rein him in at times. Very, very high usage rate, like probably could be slightly more efficient, but my understanding, he's got a little bit of a quick trigger, and his stats did drop off somewhat dramatically when he played against better competition. But, again, he's being recruited by high majors at this point. So, an intriguing target. One guy that you didn't mention but is on the board, but we haven't heard as much about that I just wanted to talk about is Ruben Chinyelu from Washington State. This is a guy who's 6'11, just played his freshman year. And according to the advanced stats, this guy is like far and away the best defensive player on the board right now. And only as a freshman. He didn't play enough minutes to qualify for a lot of the national stats, but his block rate otherwise would have been at the top 30 of all players in the country. Washington State had the number 26 KenPom defense, and he actually led them in defensive box plus minus as a true freshman, playing only 34% of the time. So I kind of love the idea of him like anchoring the middle on D around a bunch of other guys who would carry the load more on offense. One red flag with him is he was only 23 for 47 from the free throw line. So if USC is prioritizing getting into the bonus early, it could lead to teams, doing a hack-a Ruben to put him at the line. But otherwise, a really intriguing player. I think USC's board, from what I've seen so far, tends to lean heavy offense and less so on defense, especially the commits that they have and Clark and Josh right now are really like offense first type players. So it might be very useful to have kind of a big anchor in the middle.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that, and I think he would be a good. It would be good to match him as a supplement with Cohen. You could probably even play Cohen at some four if you needed to. Just a couple comments on Keyshawn Hall and Dre Davis. There was actually some similarities between the two of them in the style of their game. Hall's a little bit taller, but Dre Davis, I mean, he's listed as a guard, but you know, he came out of high school at 170 pounds at 6'5". Now he's 220 at 6'5". He's a thick kid, and his style of play, I mean, he really kind of, he does a lot of post up, a lot of mid range. He's not like a pure like shooting guard at all. If you see his style, scores a lot at the rim. Keyshawn Hall, he actually, his style reminds me a lot of Paul Pierce. He really tries to get in, like, you know, making moves, trying to get to the mid range, trying to get to the rim a little bit with kind of just like slowly getting there. So interesting, those guys, they'd be make for an interesting combo. Nick, any thoughts on these guys or anyone?
Yeah, both of them are pretty versatile too. I mean, both Hall and Davis, I think, can play the 3-4. Davis more of a wing, but as Jason hit on, a really good shot blocker for 6-6. Hall's also a great rebounder. He would have been an awesome fit actually on this past year's team where we really struggled to rebound. But yeah, he was top 40 in the country in defensive rebounding rate at George Mason. But yeah, I mean, him being clearly the best player on a top 100 KenPom team, very impressive year from him. I don't know if I like fully trust his jump shot. It's a little bit weird mechanically. Davis is, you know, I think he repeats his mechanics better. So trust his shooting a little bit more. But yeah, I think both these guys would be great pickups. Chin Yelu, yeah, on a per minute basis, really exceptional, both as a shot blocker and a rebounder. So he'll get paid in the portal for sure.
So one of my curiosities is going to be what exactly we do at the guard position, particularly because now we've let, you know, Darren Boyd sign with a mid-major in Charleston. I mean, probably if we wanted to press that, could have like said, hey, you know, you need to look at us harder. It makes me think that like Mus has other plans. Maybe that is Marquez Warrick and possibly Alston Mason from Missouri State. I'm just not sure. I like both those guys. You know, the Shane Montgomery thing is the other kind of like unknown piece here, where there's not a lot of information coming out about those guys. Guys are starting to commit, but there's still, I mean, most of the guys in the portal, even most of the top guys in the portal, have not committed yet. A lot are taking trips this weekend. So there's all kinds of rumors about who is tripping to what schools. SC is supposed to be hosting Dre Davis and Bryce Pope from UC San Diego. Pope, I'd be surprised if we move forward with Pope, but I just don't know. UCLA is supposed to be hosting. So let me get into this maybe a little bit and just, you know, take your guys' temperature on this. So Mick Cronin has already gotten commitments from Sky Clark and Kobe Johnson. The rumors are that he's supposed to get a commitment from Dominic Harris, the former Gonzaga player who played with the Mobley brothers in high school and had a really kind of nice shooting year at LMU. He's supposed to be joining them. And then this weekend, UCLA is supposed to be hosting both Eric Daly from Oklahoma State and Oregon State's power forward who had a really good Tyler Bilodeau at power forward. You know, Nick, what do you think about kind of the guys that UCLA is targeting versus the guys it seems like we are targeting?
Just a little bit different stylistically. I mean, Cronin is going after a lot of these high major guys that were maybe on like weaker high major teams. I mean, Oklahoma State with Daly, they weren't very good. Kobe Johnson with SC. SC had a disappointing year last year, right? Bilodeau fits that profile too with Oregon State. I kind of like the guys that we're pursuing better. I think there's a little more length and athleticism there. But, you know, Mick is prioritizing, with the exception of Kobe, who I think he just saw fit in this Jalen Clark role, going more for the skill route with Bilodeau and Harris, guys that aren't as twitchy, but, you know, guys that he thinks has the skill and maybe he can coach the defense out of them a little bit.
So I was joking. Jason's joking with Nick offline that it seemed like Mick is charting like the third and fourth best players on really bad power conference teams, and in the case of LMU, like a kind of a not so good mid major. What are your thoughts about targeting that those kind of guys? The third or fourth best guy on a kind of a bad power conference team versus just going for like the best player on some mid major that maybe did well and maybe struggled.
I think it's a case by case thing. I think there's kind of pros and cons both ways. I do think generally, if we kind of zoom out and look at USC's recruiting board, I do think Muss is casting a wider net for players than he ever did at Nevada and Arkansas in terms of who we're looking at in the transfer portal. If you look at like some of the national transfer rankings, Evan Miakawa, right? Like it seems like we're reaching a little bit lower than Muss did at Arkansas on some of these offers. But I also think that makes a lot of sense when you've got 9, 10, 11 roster spots to fill. And it'll be interesting as some of those guys start to lock in a space. I can see him getting more and more selective. So it's kind of a chicken egg situation, right? Like, do you try to reel in the big fish first and then go for the depth, or do you build out from the bottom and then kind of go star hunting at the end? Right now, it seems like we're in on a lot of quality guys, maybe not the marquee of the marquee guys, save, Dre Davis and a few other guys on the board. But if we grab several more mid-tier kind of guys, I think we can run out a deeper team than we did last year. So that would be kind of an interesting thing to note in Muss's first year. Like you've got a lot of kind of option two, three, and four type guys, and kind of first man off the bench. But like who's going to be the superstar? I don't think we know that yet. Last thing I wanted to hit on, we were talking about the guards. Like, do we know what's up with Caliph Battle yet? Because that would be one place to potentially turn. We know that it works with Muss already, but I haven't seen anything in terms of what his recruitment looks like out of the portal.
Yeah, that's
You
been.
know,
Go ahead, Nick.
oh, I was just gonna say he put out a tweet saying like it was something like, "I need me some NIL or something," something like that. So that's going to be, I think, a bidding war for him. But he has the familiarity with Moss, and he had a decent year with Arkansas. I wouldn't say he was great, but he was a lot better than some of the other transfers that they brought in.
Yeah, well, he had a very interesting year because he went through a real, true kind of like cold streak where he wasn't putting up hardly anything. Yeah, he's on Twitter, so you'll see him tweeting every now and then. And he did make that comment about wanting NIL, and then obviously deletes the tweet. But to just give you an idea of like where his season kind of rounded out last year, he went through a period from the end, basically the very end of the year, December 30th, up through mid-February, where I mean he had games where he didn't score at all. He only played a few minutes. He had only a couple games where he got into double digits, so that was like 11 points in those games. And then somehow he goes from this where he's averaging, I think, probably about 4 points a game, 4 points a game for like a month and a half of the season, all of January, half of February. And then he gets into what's are like the last nine games of the season. And all of a sudden he decides I'm going to like attack the rim and do the must thing and try to get as many free throw attempts as possible. And he averages 26.7 points per game over the last nine games. So that's a pretty remarkable change from averaging about 4 or 5 points a game to 26.7. Maybe, excuse me, maybe, there is that connection with Musk. We don't know. We really don't know. And that's kind of the big question about what, because that was kind of what I was going to bring next to you guys is let's say we're able to get some of these, to get these guys. What if we're able to get, Keyshawn Hall and we're able to get Dre Davis and we're able to get, Jordan Durkac from Merrimack. I think then it depends on what the guards look like. But are we starting to look like a tournament team at that point? What do you think, Nick?
Yeah, you can throw maybe Tremont Mark in there in the Caliph Battle group as Arkansas guy. We don't really know how that's going to go, but really solid high major level player. Yeah, I mean, it'd be really interesting. Stylistically, I think you're starting to build out a pretty good defense, which would get a lot of turnovers and steals. Don't really know how the shooting looks. If you get a guy like Dirk Hack with Dre Davis, it's a little more certain. I think how he'd shoot. But then we got some slacker. It's an interesting, I think, seventh guy from Penn. He doesn't really fit that Musk prototype of the super twitchy guard, but his skill level is really high, and I think the shooting is going to translate with him. Really good stroke, put up the percentages on high volume for Penn last year. Cohen, we talked about him, kind of Chavez Goodwin-y, maybe a little bit better, but center without a lot of lift, but takes up a lot of space and can score and get some rebounds. So, no, I'm intrigued. I think, you're starting to see a Big Ten level roster in here with some of these guys. And, I think who you close with, that's really going to determine whether you can, make the tournament and maybe get like a 6 or 7 seed.
Yeah. And Jason, going back to what some of the comments Mus has made on, either his press conference or the little presser, the scrum he did after that, or Trojans Live, or then his podcast with Jim Rowe, I'd encourage everyone to listen to those. He gave away a lot of information. One of the things he also mentioned, he talked about, I think on Trojans Live, was not necessarily even using a conventional point guard, finding one of these 6'5" guys and letting him take over the reins of point guard. I'm not sure how I feel about that, but that's something that, I think Mus is open to that concept. It's kind of an NBA type of thing. What are your thoughts here, Jason? Do you think if he was able to bring in Dirk Hack, let's say he brings in Dirk Hack, Montgomery, Dre Davis, Kobe, Keyshawn Hall, and then also brings in Chenelu, do you think is that a tournament team? Where do you think that team looks personnel wise?
I think you're a ball handler short, probably, right? Like I heard Mus say that, like, oh, I don't need a traditional point guard. I'll just put a 6'6" guy out there who's got decent handles. I think that's a lot of guys who use a lot of possessions individually and not a lot of facilitation and assists to get the ball to them. So, it's good bones. Like, I like where it's going, but I think you need someone else in the backcourt. I think you also probably need a little bit more shooting to space the floor. I mean, unless you were really going to run out, like, four guys that are going to take turns going ISO and just trying to get to the free throw line, I think you need maybe a little bit more in the backcourt. But it's getting there, right? One other guy, just looking at the board one more time here, Chase, that I wanted to mention. Great Osabor from Utah State. He is someone that caught my eye, right, as the second leading minute getter on a very good Utah State team last year. Again, super high usage rate, but very, very efficient. 59% on almost 350 two-point attempts, and he got to the line at the ninth best rate of any qualifying player in the country last year. He actually shot 276 free throws by himself. Just to put that in perspective, Isaiah Collier, right, who we know was pretty prolific at drawing fouls this past year, he only shot 156 free throws to lead USC, and this guy shot 276. Also nationally ranked in rebounding on offensive and defensive end at KenPom. So I would love his fit as well with what we know about Coach Mus and what he wants to run.
Yeah, and I think, look, I would love to get Osabor. I wonder, there's all these rumors that he's going to follow Sprinkle to Washington. Maybe he will, maybe he won't, but there's a lot of programs after him. I sometimes try to look on when there's a tweet and you have all the lists of schools. If SC is near the top, I mean, it's clearly not an alphabetical list. So sometimes I think, well, maybe we have a better shot there, on the Middle Tennessee State transfer, Jared Coleman Jones. He's a little bit higher. I wonder if SC has a higher shot. I just have no idea. I do agree with ball handling, but then again, there are guys like Alston from Missouri State that he maybe he's the ball handler. Alston Mason, maybe he's the ball handler. But these are all points well made, and I think we do need a true point, at least one true point out there to handle the ball. All right, let's move on. A couple, I will go on a little bit of a one of our longtime listeners who gives us feedback. He actually sent me a private email, and he had expressed a thought. You know, here's basically saying he was concerned that the level of transferring now is going to, it's just like, you know, you're not seeing any retention of players. So you're getting a brand new team every year, and maybe Musk is going to be contributing to that, but his style, it's one thing to bring in a couple transfers, but if it's rebuilding an entire team, and, you know, we're seeing something similar to this just nationwide, is there's, like, I'll check the number right now, but the number of players that have entered the transfer portal this time around, it's like, it really has, you know, it's gotten kind of crazy. And I think there's, over 1,600 in the transfer portal for, you know, 350 teams. And those teams have a lot of seniors on there. So those guys, and we're losing eligibility. So he was just expressing, he brought up this old Jerry Seinfeld joke that said, you know, when the pros got their free agencies in the 70s, basically, you were no longer rooting for the players, you're rooting for the jerseys, and your job just means you're rooting for laundry, you know, the cloth. I'm not, you know, at SC, I see it a little bit different. I mean, but the football team has never had the names on the back of the jerseys. You're always supposed to be rooting for the team, not necessarily the players. But I don't know, Nick, do you have any thoughts on this? And there's a lot of talk this week about the turnover being a big negative. I don't know. What do you think?
I understand where he's coming from with that point. What I would say is you've had a ton of great Trojans that have only spent a year at USC. Evan Mobley spent a year at USC. DeMar DeRozan spent a year at USC. Taj Eady spent a year at USC, right? So both from the one and done side and the transfer side, you've had guys kind of just make a pit stop at USC and have made substantial impacts on the basketball program with some great winning moments. So, you know, I think it's just part of the deal in 2024. But, you know, compare that to like a mid-major program in 2024, where you see like a Jordan Durkak, if you're a Merrimack fan, right? He goes, wins conference player of the year or whatnot, and then, oh, bye, I'm going to go hit the portal and, you know, go get some NIL. So, I mean, you're going to see a lot of turnover at the high major level, but it's just so much easier to build a quality roster at the high major level with resources than it is at the mid-major level with without the resources.
Jason, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, things are changing. When you have 1,600 guys in the portal, that is different than having even 600. What are your thoughts about that?
Sure. No, I totally agree with Nick's sentiment, right? And with the comment that was made, right? Like, I think that's part of the reason too why you see the women's tournament rise, right? Like, the players stay in school for 4 years. They don't transfer as much, although they're starting to, but you've still got that kind of old school feeling where one season ends and you can legitimately say, hey, next year we bring back this player and that player, we should be able to make a run next year, as opposed to like starting back at square one. But I think like that's just not the reality that we live in anymore in men's college basketball. And to not embrace the portal means you're not playing to win at this point, right? Andy last year was seemingly infatuated with the idea of pulling in a top high school class, but aside from Isaiah Collier, those guys were not prepared to be major contributors for a good team in a power conference. So now the coach is gone and all those players are gone too. So it's a little bit like, what was the point, right? Like let someone else be the training and proving ground for guys at a lower level. And when they show the ability to be a contributor at an elite level, then you bring them in and you hand over the NIL dollars. So I guess I'm trying to say, you know, coaches need to embrace this new world, and that's how teams are going to get good. But certainly from a fan's perspective, I appreciate that sentiment. I think at the end of the day, if we are the diehard fans we say we are, yeah, we will continue to root for the laundry. And I know maybe that's not the most satisfying answer, but I think that's just kind of where we're at in 2024.
A couple thoughts just on what you're talking about, being proving grounds. Keyshawn Hall did not start his collegiate career at George Mason. He actually started at UNLV and did not find immediate success there, moved over to George Mason, I think, which is a clear step down. Similarly, Alston Mason started at Oklahoma and then moved on to Missouri State. That's a pretty significant step down. Jarrett Coleman Jones did not start his career at Middle Tennessee State. He started at Northwestern, and he had to make that step down. So some of these guys have found themselves like they're not quite ready to get serious minutes at the high major level that they were recruited into. They take a step down, develop their game. I mean, it's almost like a minor league in some ways. It is a great proving ground. The NCAA has their efforts to limit transfers has been blocked by the courts now. So this is not going to change unless you get actual collective bargaining. And there's a lot of reasons why collective bargaining is probably not going to happen soon. I mean, it would actually turn the players into employees, and that would cause a lot of complications. And I'm not saying you can't work through all those complications, but there's a lot of things that, it will trigger things that people haven't really considered, including like cutting players, things like that, that we don't really see nowadays in collegiate sports. I'm not sure if that would happen. So as under the current kind of system of NCAA rules being then overridden by courts, open transfers are here to stay. I think the one thing that could limit transfers in the future is structuring the NIL deals more cleverly, essentially having money vest after players, spend their 4 years at the school. That I think is an interesting, and I'm sure they want to do that. And players want the cash up front. I know that's the way it works. But if you could do it in a way that, like, let's say the money is being held in a third party escrow, they know it's there, they know it's coming if they stay at the school. That would be one way to structure it. That would maybe keep players around more, and I think it's probably being done in some circumstances. And then the other thing that's kind of unrelated to this, but I thought, what would probably enhance the overall experience? And I'd like to hear your guys' feedback on this. We've had the COVID fifth year. What would you guys think of the NCAA added back in and made it permanent of players being permitted, let's say, as long as they graduated within 4 years or something like that, or had maintained some sort of academic status that they got they were eligible for a fifth year of college. Any thoughts on that as a possible rule change?
I can start here. I really like the idea of it. I think we've had a really good college product over the last couple of years here with the maturity level of the players. It's also, these are the prime earning years for a lot of these either fringe NBA players or guys that would otherwise play in Europe, or even, the guys that weren't good enough to play professionally. I mean, to the extent that they can make NIL while in college, I think that's phenomenal and, gives them a great jump start from a money standpoint on life. So I love it from that standpoint and from the product standpoint too. I'm skeptical that they're gonna go that route just because people have traditionally just thought of college as a 4-year process. And then do you do that for football too? I think there are a lot of interesting questions there, but I'd be in favor of it.
Yeah, I agree that I love it for the players. I'm not sure that I love it for the sport, just in the sense that, like, if we do have this kind of feedback coming in that, oh, we're just playing for the laundry, everyone keeps transferring, like, you don't know where the player's gonna end up next, right? Like, one of the easiest spigots and maybe only ones to left to turn off for the NCAA at this point, like with all the litigation and everything else, is like, just, hey, everybody agreed once upon a time you were in college for 4 years. If you redshirt, you can get the fifth year, but that meant you didn't play 1 year, so you get to play 4 years. Like, that would control kind of rein that in a little bit. So if the goal is to rein it in, that's one easy way to rein it back in a little bit, to not extend that out past the guys that were in college in 2020 and 2021. But it would be certainly good for the players. Did we lose Chase? Are you on mute there?
I think we might have.
Yeah, sorry, guys. Before we get out of here, I want to just say that I want to go over Nick had the opportunity to go to the McDonald's All-American game, I think for the boys and the girls, a week and a half ago. And, you know, I watched it. Just, you know, Nick, want to get your impression of the players you saw and, you know, just kind of global thoughts.
Yeah, sure. So always a fun event. I went last year and then this past year too. I've been in Houston both years. So it seems like a bit of a down year talent-wise. There was a gap, I think, from about, you know, 7 onward. You kind of have the group of like Cooper Flagg, Ace Bailey, BJ Edgecombe really pops athletically. Definitely throw Dylan Harper in there, Trey Johnson from Texas. Those guys all had their moments. The guy that really impressed me was actually Derek Queen, who's going to Maryland. Doesn't seem like he's going to be a hyper elite pro prospect because he's more of a throwback big, 6'10", 240, great hands, good on the glass. So that's the kind of dude that's going to be super productive in college and make a lot of NIL money along the way. But, you know, even, you know, with that top group of Bailey, Flagg, those guys, I just don't know how much they're going to impact winning at the college level. I mean, Cooper Flagg's got a super funky shot. I think he went 3 for 9 in the game. Ace Bailey, I mean, looks like a million bucks, and it's going to be a great NBA wing once he gets the skill. But I just don't know. He might be like an empty calories guy that averages 14, 15 a game on a Rutgers team that doesn't make the tournament. Dylan Harper blended it well. He's a, you know, legit 6'6", 210. Can conceivably score at all three levels, but don't know if he's like a dynamite jump shooter yet. You know, beyond that, I'll give Trent Perry a shout out. He played in the game, former USC signee who they're still recruiting. Probably the least athletic kid there, but really high IQ guy. Always made the right read. Shot looks good. Going to be a really solid, I think, four-year college guard. But yeah, but, you know, I can see why the portal is so desirable because, you know, outside of like Derek Queen, not sure how many of these dudes are going to be playing super high level roles on title contenders.
Yeah. And I'll just add a little bit. I mean, I think it's great for Rutgers that they're getting Dylan Harper with Ace Bailey, because like Bailey's going to score points. I think he'll have a better season than let's say like Zaire Williams did, but like he's you know, there's a lot of bad decision-making there and him playing like too fast, and maybe he'll get it under control, but he seems just like, you know, these wings, the high ranked wings, they always seem to be the guys that like don't perform on the college level the way they will eventually perform in the NBA. I do agree about Cooper Flagg. I mean, he's looked so amazing at different times, you know, kind of the prep school level, AAU level. But yeah, the offense, I think when you put him into a structured offense, there's going to be some struggles there. I think Dylan Harper is an excellent candidate for having like a pretty good season scoring wise and with efficiencies. I like Edgecombe. You know, I liked Derek Queen probably the best. I mean, he, you know, should be making a major impact for Maryland. We'll see. He's not, you know, ranked top 10 by the services, which is interesting. Beyond that, yeah, I agree. It's like these guys, I mean, even when they'll flash at times, but you could, they're just, the age matters, the maturity matters, the refining of the skill level matters. And, you know, these guys just don't look as nearly as refined as the players like I watched in the Final Four, you know, playing. It's just, it's remarkable. And that includes like Final Four players like, you know, DJ Horn for North Carolina State, who, you know, just last year was kind of like a high volume guy for Arizona State. I guess he had some efficiencies, but never someone that's going to scare you. And then he and Burns take North Carolina State to the Final Four, which is pretty amazing. And that's a lot of that has to do with maturity and development of the game and refinement of the game over time. I agree with you on Trent Perry. He looked like he could at least control the ball. And I think he's a guy, I think I've said this several times, that by the end of his sophomore year, I think he could average like 12 points a game. And then, you know, by the time he's a junior and senior, he could actually be a real a big impact guy in college. Zoom looked good to me, Zoom Diallo, but he didn't really like finish or anything. I don't, you know, I wouldn't necessarily want to have him as my starting point guard coming into next season. Carter Bryant going to Arizona. Like, I've never really been impressed by Carter Bryant. So I'm not sure where that leaves us. Jason, do you have any thoughts on any of these guys, or just the kind of concept of the McDonald's All-American versus like the key mid-major transfer?
Look, one thing, going back to Muss's press conference, he did say the only way to win big is you've got to get five-star high school players that are NBA lottery picks or at least NBA first-round picks. So, you know, that would be out of this crop of guys, and maybe it's just a down year, but it's going to be really interesting to see what kind of emphasis our program places on going after these guys, right? You know, and we'll see in 2025, 2026 classes in Southern California, like who's out there and who we really start to target, because I do think it's a balancing act. You've got to be active in the portal, but there's probably a role, right, for the truly great high school player as well.
Yeah, and Nick, maybe you can just take over with, especially 2025, extending outside of Southern California up to like maybe Napa, and then in 2026, Southern California.
Yeah, I mean, 25 is not the best, you know, California class. AJ DeBanza is really the exception there, playing at Prolific Prep. He's visited USC, he's visited Auburn. This was pre-coaching carousel, so you have to see how that looks now. But DeBanza, I think, fits the category of truly unique generational talent. I mean, I think he's certainly a more natural scorer than Cooper Flagg, you know, a little more athletic than Cam Boozer, just exceptional player. And, you know, beyond that, you don't have a ton of can't-miss guys in California in that 2025 class. I think Braden Burries is getting recruited by Duke. So, you know, he's a pretty high profile guy, but I like Nick Kamenia a lot at Harvard Westlake. Gonzaga's in pretty deep there, but you know, these other guys are kind of more like just a guy. Whereas, you know, that 2026 class, you've got four of the top five players in the country are from California. Brandon McCoy, Tyron Stokes, Elijah Arenas, Jason Crow. And, you know, we can even drill down into those guys more. But Chase, talking with you offline, we kind of think that Brandon McCoy and Elijah Arenas are probably the, you know, the best players in the country and have the greatest chance to become superstars from that crop.
Well, so Brandon McCoy is currently ranked number one in 24/7. He's number two in the composite. He's at St. John Bosco. Elijah Arenas, who's Gilbert Arenas' son, who plays at Chatsworth, I think is the superior player. And I'm not degrading Brandon McCoy at all. Elijah Arenas, I think, is the best high school player I've seen really from the West Coast since Evan Mobley. And there was an interesting moment this week because, you know, Elijah's father, Gil, has a podcast where he says a lot of interesting things. But the topic of Musselman actually came up on the podcast in connection with talking about Bronny. And I, you know, didn't realize it, but Muss actually coached Gilbert Arenas at Golden State. I was sure that Gilbert was going to have something negative to say, but no, he actually was very positive on Musselman, which is interesting. He seemed to like Musselman quite a bit. He thinks that Musselman really helped out his career. Interesting to note. There's a third player in that class from Linwood, Jason Crow Jr. Very high scorer, a big time scorer in high school. I don't think he's kind of got like the athleticism that you see from McCoy or Arenas as far as maybe a future NBA guy, but you know, he's a guy that if he stuck around in college a couple of years could be a big difference. I think, you know, going back to Jason's comments or noting what Musselman had said, I think what he said was supposed to in part be for the ears of guys like DeBanza and Brandon McCoy and Arenas and Crow, maybe even, I don't know, Koa Pete, who's out here in Arizona, played for Compton Magic, I think Nick, you're not a huge fan, but SC didn't really make any headway with him when Andy was the coach. I wonder if he's thinking, hey, I can circle back to that and start making some headway. That's interesting to me. But I think Musselman is certainly thinking about, I'm almost positive about this, is, you know, trying to build the foundation with maybe some of these mid-major transfer guys. And then, you know, on sprinkle on top of that, some of these like elite players that are going to be like lottery picks. And he'll have to raise the NIL to do that. But I think that's what his plan probably is. Any thoughts on that, Jason, before we get out of here?
No, it makes sense as a plan, Chase. And, you know, on that topic of like building the foundation, getting guys in here, right? One other interesting thing from what Musk said last week is, you know, he was asked very directly, like, what is your recruiting pitch, right? And I've heard past USC coaches in multiple sports answer that, you know, hey, you're here in Southern California, top-notch university, you know, he could say, we're going to play exciting basketball, up-tempo, and you get to go to a great school and that kind of like cookie-cutter platitudes. But instead, he really talked about like building out 8 to 12 month individual player development plans and visions for every player, like what he thinks they need to work on. And then what does your year look like from the off season work into the fall, into the season, and potentially, you know, beyond college. And I actually think that's like a really smart way to look at things, because it's just a reality of everything we've been talking about during this conversation, right? Like this portal era, you're working 1 year at a time. You're not thinking about having warm, fuzzy feeling and, oh, this guy's going to be here for 3 years and it's going to be great. It's like, hey, here's what I see on film. This is what we're going to get you better at right now, so you can get drafted or you can, you know, move up, and here's what your time with me is going to look like. So I think, you know, yeah, you bring in the transfers to start, and then you try to layer on top some really, really talented freshmen. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable way to go about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Great point. Nick, you got anything before we get out of here?
Yeah, totally agree with what both you guys said. The Trojans Live interview with Musselman was super insightful, and his comments on getting that elite one and done talent, he was talking about that for a reason. And I definitely think it's to get the ears of the elite 2025 and 2026 players. One thing I'll also note too is, you know, assuming that the NCAA doesn't enshrine that fifth year of eligibility moving forward, I do think the value of one and dones is going to go back up, just because, you know, they're going to be competing against freshmen through, you know, senior level players as opposed to freshmen through super senior level players. So the average age in the sport should be going down a little bit. So you combine that factor with the fact that California has this elite 2026 class, and I think it totally makes sense why he's making those comments publicly. And he just reoffered Elijah Arenas within the last few days here. So definitely a name for USC fans to file away.
All right. Well, look, appreciate it, guys. We will be back hopefully soon with another one of these. I think we'll give it maybe a week's time, but hopefully by the time we have our next podcast, we've already got a couple, you know, commits out of the transfer portal. Hopefully we'll have more of a foundation. Maybe we'll have a Keyshawn Hall pop or somebody else. But until then, everyone, fight on.
Fight on.
Fight on.